Hello, and welcome to our daily check-in here at KBIA, where we're checking in with each other each weekday at this time and place for community connection and conversation over the airwaves. Thank you for being here. You know, with any crisis, and especially it seems like this one, comes a lot of questions as things unfold quickly. Also, sometimes a lot of confusion from the public and experts alike. The medical experts communicate what they know based on what they understand at the time. And then as they learn more, sometimes those messages change. That can create a space that can be filled by misinformation. And all of this is a reminder, this is what journalists are for, to help us interpret things quickly, evolving messages with reliability, accuracy, and speed, if we can manage it. So our guest today is busy doing just that. Ruby Bailey is the executive editor of the Columbia Missourian. She's also an experienced crisis reporter, so she's going to be with us throughout this half hour to talk about the challenges of getting and giving good information during a crisis. Ruby will be joining us this half hour, and you also can join our discussion. What do you want to know about covering a crisis, specifically a pandemic, and how are you staying informed? What challenges have you found in the mixed messages that you might have heard and sorting through it all? Have you relied on a particular journalistic source to do this? And before we go to Ruby Bailey, we have with us someone whose voice is very recognizable to NPR listeners. David Folkenflik is a longtime NPR correspondent. He's the media correspondent for NPR. He's also a well-known host and a very familiar voice. So he's basically looking into all the time how the media are doing their job. Welcome, David Folkenflik.
Jen, a pleasure to join.
So, David, you know, first, let me start with general thoughts. We're all watching this crisis unfold, but you're watching from the vantage point of NPR and from the vantage point of looking at how journalists are handling this crisis. What have been your big takeaways and observations during this time?
I mean, the biggest one, there are a lot of different threads to follow and tug on, right? But the biggest one to follow is just how many people, despite a pandemic, despite concerns for the health of their family and loved ones and friends and colleagues, are working their tails off. Days blur into nights, days blur into weekends. There's no real separation of work and not work. And yet, you know, people have kids to take care of, as I do. People have obligations and worries and parents and others that they are very concerned about. And they are churning out so much work about such a complex topic that have such impact and implications for their listeners or readers or viewers. You've got to admire people running toward working hard on these difficult issues, sometimes exposing themselves to this pandemic as well. And there's certainly a number of cases where journalists have contracted it. And some of the less famous cases, you know, are not cable news stars making millions of dollars, but people who, you know, are making modest living, trying to do the best to inform their communities.
You're so right. It's such a great point that, you know, I feel this. I'm sure everybody on the KBIA news team feels this, that you really are covering something that's impacting you personally a lot more in some ways than usual when we're covering things. There's always a little bit of that, but this crisis is particularly evolving and scary and uncertain, I would say. But what, David, have you seen from your front row seat? Does any of the coverage or reporters actually stand out for you?
I mean, I can think of a bunch of individual accounts. There's a lot of, you know, I can think of a colleague of mine in China, you know, going in Wuhan, reporting from essentially the front lines of this. I can think of people doing the same in Italy. A terrific CNN report and a CBS report from inside hospitals.
Yeah.
One of the most difficult things about this is that we get these reports and they're written or described and characterized, but you're not hearing it from the people in the moment as it's happening, because hospitals, A, have privacy concerns for patients, and B, are completely overridden, you know, in the areas where these are hotspots, particularly in New York, where I live and report. And yet that kind of access is necessary to really bring this to life. And people have done that, and people have gone there and, you know, really had to cover themselves up and hope that they're not exposing themselves to it, but have done that in an effort to try to explain this. I think people have done heroic work. The New York Times did this wonderful reporting using email threads from these senior governmental scientists and public health experts about their mounting concern from mid-January. And, you know, the headline was, he could have known about it, and it was about the president, where he kept saying no one could have known. Well, actually, these warnings were being sounded. People were setting off flare guns, metaphorically, to try to get the attention of their bosses. And when they did, when the Secretary of Health went to the president twice in January, early February, and said this is really serious, he was essentially slapped down by the president. And the email chains were able to show this and documentable. It's not just assertion, but it's on the record in ways that are convincing to me. You've seen local reporters, even as they're being furloughed, you know, that is, they say, for the Gannett newspaper company, which owns newspapers in more than 200 communities and owns USA Today, they've said you're taking a week's furlough every month for the indeterminate future while this pandemic has caused this financial crisis. And it's meant that people are essentially taking a 20 to 25% pay cut for the near future, medium range future, and they're still going about their jobs trying to inform people. And I've seen NPR and others, but, you know, from inside, I've seen NPR colleagues are banding together, most of them from home, to overcome even greater technical logistics than usual, but still to provide a layered, textured, nuanced coverage that still hits hard about what's happening, what people are doing on our effect, how people are coming together, and how things at times fall apart. And I find it very stirring. I think journalism at these moments really embraces its mission. You see at times commercial TV news organizations trying to be public services, get information out. Where can you get food? Where can you get blood? Where can you get reserves? What things are safe and what are more concerned? They're doing their best, even if imperfectly, to get the best information they have and convey it in a sound way.
Well, thank you, David, for reminding us and actually using the word stirring to describe some of the journalism that's out there. I think that's a good reminder for us that people, as you say, are really working hard, doing their best. A lot of the times, our favorite media outlets are really running marathons to try to make this happen. And David, you've been covering media during the Trump era, and you bring up the president, his messaging. This is a good day in some ways to have this conversation because there's a press conference, I think, just yesterday with Dr. Anthony Fauci. There have been mixed messages from the president and, you know, his lead medical advisor, Anthony Fauci. What is going on there as journalists try to sort through the different messages?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of different messages. There are different messages just about the president's level of support for his top you know, pandemic expert, Fauci, yes, who's been there serving Republican and Democratic presidents for decades in that role. There's also been mixed messages from the presidential lectern about almost everything, much of which focuses on how he's being treated by the press, by the public, by governors, in a way that's sort of a distraction from how the government is addressing the pandemic and what we're seeing and what we understand. And to be fair to him and others, including Fauci, sometimes their messages have been confusing and misleading and mixed because their understanding of circumstances are changing. And so that's a real problem as well. But the president himself has, he's almost acknowledged this publicly, been forced to take this seriously, been forced to take serious and in some ways effective policies in order to address this against his will and against his inclinations and gut instincts. And he's been kind of transparent about that, even as he's been fighting against that and fighting against criticism of him for taking as long as he did to get there in a number of these instances. You know, Fauci has come forward and said there's no differentiation between the president and myself. He said that when he and another top government official on public health in relationship to addressing the pandemic have gone to the president and told him specifically, we want you to declare X or we want you to do Y, he said the president listened and adopted that policy. When he said you have to extend this beyond mid-April, the president assented or acquiesced, however you want to phrase it. In that sense, they're working in concert. Clearly, behind the scenes, the president has been irritated by the need to do this, and Fauci at times has been in favor. Yesterday, the president sort of had Fauci say a few words relatively quickly after starting his briefing. That hasn't always been the case. That's a way of deferring to public authorities. And then after a few minutes, kind of took the lectern back over and showed a propagandistic video propounding how brilliant he is. So there's a tension there between the president's political impulses and the public health needs. The PRESA did in that press briefing, even as I take exception to the live blanket coverage of these things every day, as opposed to reporting on them and then presenting reports after the fact, the reporters in that briefing, John Carl, Caitlin Collins of CNN, Paula, I'm forgetting her last name, forgive me, Paula Reed of CBS News, they did a great job of asking fairly pointed but meaningful, substantive questions in the moment of the President of the United States at a time when he's clearly feeling combative about what he did and challenging him on his self-praise in ways that I think are valuable for people to hear and see, to know that that narrative of events is not the only understanding of what we have of what happened. But the most important thing is for reporters getting out the understanding of the medicine, the epidemiology, and understanding and reflecting things that we don't 100% entirely always know. We don't always have these things perfectly pinned down, and they're not always the same story in late February, may be a little different than mid-March, may be different than now in mid-April.
All right. You're listening to our live daily check-in here on KBIA, and we're speaking with David Folkenflik, a recognizable voice because he's the media correspondent and a longtime host as well for NPR. You can join us. What are your questions about how the media are doing as they cover this crisis? David, we're almost at the end of our time with you, but since I have you here, I want to ask for any final thoughts or takeaways you would like us to keep in mind here in Missouri as we're watching coverage and listening to coverage.
Well, I mean, the first thing, public health notion is take this stuff seriously, wash your hands, treat each other well, treat yourself well, to figure out ways to take emotional and mental break and see if you can find things to consume in the media that help you to do that. I think that's important. I'd also say be critical listeners, viewers, and readers. Take seriously what you're hearing, but also take a moment to say, how do I know what I know? Are they presenting links? Are they presenting evidence? Are they citing authoritative sources? Or are they just kind of fulminating? You know, we've seen an incredible thirst for our coverage on places like NPR.org, non-ideological coverage, authoritative coverage, but a lot of news sources have across the country as well, even as finances are being not pinched but hammered. So I'd say have an appreciation for getting authoritative information and also find ways to support it. They're hurting too. These are businesses as well. Some of them, like ours and at KBIA, not for profit, and they can use your support. We can use your support, and newspapers that are doing the job can probably as well. This is a time that is a time of peril for the country. It's a time of existential peril for some news outlets. Are they going to survive the pandemic long enough to be able then to confront the difficulties, their finances that were existing even before this ever washed ashore?
Okay, David, thank you so much. And I have to say, congratulations on a really big report that you have on NPR about Bloomberg investigations and the media coverage of a report that got pulled. So people can check that out on NPR.org. One final question, David, before we let you go. You know, you have a personal connection here to the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA.
Sure.
How are you and your family doing as producers and reporters sheltering in place right now in New York?
Well, thanks for asking. My wife, Jessie Baker, a proud Mizzou graduate, and
yes,
taught briefly there as well, and spent some time with the good folks at KBIA as a student and subsequently. We're doing all right. You know, we got three kids, and we're doing the homeschooling for the older ones, and you know, connecting them online with their teachers as best we can, and doing the instruction we can, trying to get them to read. Read online or listen to audiobooks in the case of the five-year-old, and you know, occasionally allowing a treat to watch Mary Poppins during a rainy day yesterday. you know, trying to make sure things are lively and stimulating for them, and sane as we can, even as we're trying to do work, both of us in chunks around the edges, like so many Americans around the country right now.
Yeah, we all need a little Mary Poppins right now, don't we?
So. We could all use it. We could all use it. With any luck, she would have sort of this superhero immunity from coronavirus to visit us all.
Ooh, you just came up with a third installment, I think, of Mary Poppins. So.
There you go.
David, thank you so much. Hello to Jesse, and please take care. Thank you for joining us here in the middle of Missouri.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Take care. All right. You also can join us. You're listening to our live noontime check-in. And today we are going back to our conversation of the day with executive editor at the Columbia Missourian, Ruby Bailey. She's going to be with us. We do have some calls coming in. You can also join our conversation if you want to talk about the coverage you're hearing, seeing, enjoying, or not so much. Let us know how you're getting your information these days. In the meantime, we have Columbia Missourian executive editor, Ruby Bailey. Ruby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ruby, so first of all, what does the Missourian newsroom look like right now? How have your operations, which I'm assuming are largely remote, how is that going and how's everyone managing right now?
Well, our newsroom, you're right, we are largely remote. So our newsroom is pretty empty with most of our reporters and editors, photographers, graphics folk, a lot of them working from their homes. And then we have a very, very small crew that comes in to the Missourian building that's necessary for publication of our print product. So,
all right. Ruby, you've covered other crises before, and now you're covering this crisis from the middle of Missouri. What challenge, let me just give you a very general question first. What are the challenges that come from any crisis, and what are the specific challenges you're seeing as an executive editor that are coming from this one?
Well, first I would say when I was covering other events, I was not an editor. I was a reporter. So there was a big difference.
Okay.
But certainly with any crisis, it is trying to ascertain what the news is, who the sources are we need to talk to, how to keep our reporters, editors, photographers safe.
Yes.
If they have families of their own. I was in Washington, D.C. September the 11th. And so those of us who had families, if we lived in Maryland where they let schools out, if we had children we needed to get to or spouses or what have you, there were just things that were going on. Transportation systems were closed. Cell phones weren't working. And there was no one who was in charge that you were really going to be able to get over the phone.
Yeah.
So you have to understand there's going to be a certain amount of chaos and a certain vacuum of facts and information. And the last thing that we want to do as journalists and as community members is fill that vacuum or fill that void with speculation, rumor, or things that cause people to panic.
Absolutely. So I want to unpack that a little bit with you, Ruby. That's an excellent perspective. Let me just say to our listeners, you're listening to our live daily check-in. We're speaking with Ruby Bailey, executive editor of the Columbia Missourian. She's covered a lot of crisis, as she says, as a reporter. Now she's in charge of Missourian coverage as its executive editor. We're talking about how journalists navigate crisis, how we sort the good information from the bad ourselves to make sure that you get good information in a crisis. So let us know, how are you getting good information? Are you a Missourian reader? What else are you reading? What are you doing to avoid misinformation during this time? Let us know what's going on with you. Ruby, what you just said is really interesting, that you know the information is constantly evolving. It's happening quickly. You've dealt with this in Washington, D.C. after 9/11. So what are the methods that you train your staff on and work with your reporters on to deploy to get reliable information to the public?
Certainly, our faculty editors are working very hard to ensure that we go to reputable sources and mm-hmm. that we ask those reputable sources follow-up questions. So if we're looking at issues of how the virus is spread, we're not going to ask Joe Smith on the street how the virus spreads, right?
Right.
We're going to go to the CDC. We're going to go to the World Health Organization. And then we're going to hopefully begin to be able to tease out certain answers. If we get an answer where it's like, well, that's not quite clear. And if the truth of the matter is we don't know because this is a novel virus, then we have to present that context. That some of these things are what are believed at this point in time to be the best information based on what they know. These things can evolve or change.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a lot of context and asking the folks who have the answers, or at least some of the answers, asking them question after question. Well, how do you know that? Or what makes you think that? Or what research did you use to get that? Or was there a particular testing that's been done in a particular city? Have you seen an example of that in this city or that state? It's really trying to tease out some more information that we can use to give our audiences a bit more clarity and either a realistic a realistic estimate of the situation of where this person gets their information from and why they believe these things to be true, or their knowledge base.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of what I think you're talking about, Ruby, is important context. And that's why people go to trusted sources for that context. Let me bring in a caller for us. Ruby, we've got Anne is calling from Columbia on the line. Anne, thanks. Did you have a comment for us?
Yes, I did. I wanted to say that the most helpful program that I heard was very early in March before anyone was ever talking of social distancing. And the program was on Science Friday. They interviewed an epidemiologist who really explained how this was going to spread and what exponential spread was. And I knew then we were in for a long haul. And then the other shout out I want to give is to the program yesterday that interviewed Verna LaBoy. She works with the Columbia Health Department.
Yes.
With the African American community in Columbia, and she is way ahead of the curve on working on some of the problems that have drawn national attention. So okay. A shout out to the health department and Verna LaBoy.
Thank you for that, Anne. I appreciate that. And we'll continue the discussion with Verna and other colleagues this coming Monday on disparities. So keep a listen out for that. And thank you for listening, Anne, and thanks for your call. Ruby, so Anne brings up something. She says one of the most important programs she heard was Science Friday. So this is the challenge of... Yeah. Oh, good. Communicating a science story is really challenging. And like you say, you can't ask Joe on the street, no matter how friendly he is, to interpret science for you. So getting the right sourcing for this has been a particular challenge, I bet.
Well, yes, it has. If I may say one other thing, though, going back to Anne's call, we are very aware of Verna LaBoy. She won one of our awards, our Missourian Progress Award winners last year. So yes, yes. She won our Progress in Healthcare Award last year. So yes, Verna is absolutely fabulous at what she does, certainly.
Yes, that's great. Yeah.
But Ruby,
let me just give a shout out to listeners now because we've got a few minutes left. So if you want to call in and join our conversation, we're talking with Ruby Bailey, the executive editor at the Columbia Missourian. She's leading the coverage at the Missourian there as a reporter. She's documented crises, reported on crises. How are you getting your information during this crisis? Are you a journalism student or are you a journalist or just a listener consumer? Let us know how you're giving good information, how you're getting good information, how you're avoiding misinformation. Ruby, you mentioned something really important, which is the follow-up question. And so some journalists have had questions about how Governor Parson is delivering information through his Facebook Live. And even one of our colleagues, Professor Kathy Kiley, did an editorial in your paper saying that she had serious questions and concerns about the inability to do effective follow-up questions in that format. What disadvantages or advantages have you seen with the way the governor and our state leaders and other officials are providing information right now?
Okay, so one I would say, of course, I know who Kathy is, and I am also on the board of the Missouri Press Association. So I was technically on that letter that went out from the Missouri Press Association and the Missouri Broadcasters Association asking him to figure out a better way to hold briefings so that there can be that back and forth. But I will also say that at the Missourian, at least, and I believe too for the Tribune, we didn't have an indication that the governor's staff was picking and choosing particular questions to ask. Someone asked him a particularly hard question or a particularly pointed, I would say, question from, I believe, someone at the Tribune. That question was asked and it was answered. But that issue of the follow-up, which I think is really was at the heart of Kathy's column, the issue of the follow-up, being able to ask that follow-up question, and also just the ability of journalists to be able to represent the public well in the questions that we are able to ask and our access to our leaders and those who serve the public along with us. It's extraordinarily important. There is enough technology, I believe, without risking their safety or even the safety of our journalists, because we're not necessarily sending our reporters to the Capitol to cover anything. So I believe there are ways, whether it's Zoom or something else, that perhaps there is a way that is more inclusive that allows journalists to get the chance to say, excuse me, sir, I have a follow-up, or pass a question along to a colleague.
So, okay. Yeah. Great, great to know. Thank you for that perspective. Ruby, let's bring a caller in. John from Marshall, Missouri is calling us. John, did you have a question or comment for Ruby?
Sure. I just want to say, first of all, how proud I am of the heritage that we have in Central Missouri with the university and with its commitment to good journalism and how important that is now. I wanted to ask your guest about a comment that was made a long time ago when I was young, so about the 60s, by a guy named Marshall McLuhan, who used to say or said that the media was the message. I wonder now how much you see yourselves as being stepping aside and just letting the message speak, because I always thought that was sort of a strange thing to say, although I understood why he was saying it.
John, thank you for that deep think sort of communication theory question. Ruby, do you have an answer about this? I know about this, I have to admit, partly from Mad Men, as much as any journalism theory I've studied in my time. The medium is the message. Does that apply to right now or anything that we do?
Say this, and I understand his point, that the proposal was basically that the communication medium itself, not necessarily the messages, should be the primary study or a primary focus of study. So I understand what he's saying. I think when we look at social media a lot, that might be a way of kind of getting to that a little bit more. It's the media itself.
Yes.
So when, for example, when I was in D.C., we didn't have Twitter, I don't believe, at that point. Certainly there was an internet. But we did not have social media in the way that we have it now in terms of its benefits to us and to the public at large, and its challenge of spreading information extraordinarily quickly, whether it's been vetted or not.
All right, Ruby, we have maybe just a little bit of time. Thank you, John, by the way, for that intelligent question. And all questions are intelligent, actually. But Bernadette from Columbia is also calling in with a comment. Bernadette, thanks for calling us.
Hey, I'm a MU journalism grad from years ago, and I just want to stress the importance of journalism in this era that we're living in, and urge everybody to support whatever you can locally in the Missouri and KBIA, KOPN, and nationally, internationally, New York Times, The Guardian, whatever. And what an important job you're doing in these times and always. I think people don't realize, because they get information and they don't always know, you know, think about the source of what it takes to get it there to us. And so I just like to stress that. And I think we've gotten an inkling in the past few years of what journalism under a dictatorship might look like. So I just I hope that scares everybody a little bit into supporting journalism in the United States.
All right. Bernadette, thank you so much for the shout out. It's nice to hear from an alum. Thanks for listening.
Okay, bye-bye.
Calling in. Bye-bye. Ruby, we are just about out of time. I should just end really quickly by saying thank you so much for coming on, and we want to continue these discussions. Thank you for helping me field these calls, and we should just continue, and you would be the perfect person to come back and help us as we continue these conversations about how we're getting information these days.
Well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much, Ruby. We'll stay in touch. That is it for today's check-in. Thanks again to Ruby Bailey, executive editor of The Missourian, for joining us. Thank you for checking in. This program is produced by Christopher Husted and me, with KBIA's news director Ryan Familiner, Zia Kelly, Madison Conti, and Hannah France. A thank you to KBIA's on-air team. They are keeping the lights on right now for KBIA, to Kia Thomas, Aaron Hay, Darren Helwidge, and they're all led by program director Kyle Felling, who directed this show today. Also, thanks to our KBIA chief engineer, Mark Johnson. We want to know where you're at. It's a voicemail you can call, and that number is 877-532-0971. You can also get that number at kbia.org. That's all for today. Thanks for joining us. Stay well and stay in touch.